Time on Viewpoint as we confront the issues of America's heart and home.
Deeper at a Hindu monastery in northern India, and he was never ordained or qualified as a priest within the Hindu tradition. Now, when the man he worked for, the head of this monastery, died, the Maharishi went to southern India and claimed to be his successor and started up the Transcendental Meditation Movement in the 1950s. And the Maharishi figured out that there was more money to be made at this. What he was teaching was a mantra meditation. A mantra is the name of a Hindu god that he had people recite silently in their minds for 20 minutes twice a day. And he claimed that they would become spiritually enlightened and also gain paranormal powers, like the ability to levitate and fly, the ability to read minds, the ability to walk through walls, and even the ability to become invisible. So he made all of these very highfalutin claims that he said his technique would work for people. And he was really a money grubber by training. His academic background was in mathematics and science. He graduated from Allahabad University in India, which is very prestigious. But he was more or less an accountant that figured out that religion was a good way to make lots and lots of money. Now, the Maharishi came to the West in 1958 and settled in Los Angeles, where he started teaching this meditation technique to rich people there for lots and lots of money. He initially infiltrated the beatnik or beat generation movement, who were the precursors to the hippies. Now, he kept targeting wealthy people and celebrities in Los Angeles. And in 1968, he really discovered the holy grail of celebrity devotees. He recruited the Beatles, who were the biggest entertainment act in the world, and who eventually, according to the Guinness Book of World Records, are the most successful entertainers in history, having sold over 1 billion record albums.
Well, hold on that thought. We'll be back here in just a moment with William H. Kennedy. Go right ahead, William.
Well, Dr. Stan, as I was saying, the Maharishi Mahesh Yogi had the four Beatles as his devotees in 1968 and took them to Rishikesh, India, where he set up an ashram, which is kind of a Hindu monastery. Now, they stayed there for a couple weeks till they found out that the Maharishi allegedly was sexually harassing the actress Mia Farrow and her sister Prudence Farrow. And the Beatles, you know, kind of fled the monastery, went back to London, and in a press conference, they disassociated themselves from the Maharishi. Paul McCartney saying they thought he was more than he was, but he turned out to be human, and they kind of broke off from him. And from there, the Maharishi returned to the United States and steadily targeted wealthy people, claiming that TM was a form of stress reduction that was good for business people and executives. And the next big celebrity he recruited, and this is what really made him a huge international figure even more than the Beatles, Clint Eastwood, the actor from the Dirty Harry films, became one of his disciples. And through Clint Eastwood, he hooked up with Merv Griffin. For younger people, Merv Griffin was a daytime talk show host who was on par with people like David Letterman and Jay Leno today, or Oprah Winfrey. He was like the biggest daytime talk show host in the United States. Merv Griffin was also a member of the Bohemian Grove, which is an occult organization and fraternity in California that is frequented by world leaders and economic leaders, and they have an agenda to form a one-world government in a one-world economy, and they practice occult rituals. And this includes people like Ronald Reagan and Richard Nixon were members of the Bohemian Grove. But Merv Griffin had the Maharishi on his program in 1975 with Clint Eastwood, and this endorsement is what really opened people from all ages up to studying transcendental meditation, because older people really ignored him because they saw the Beatles as being kind of flaky and kind of like Timothy Leary and all that kooky 60s stuff. But Clint Eastwood, who was a very macho movie tough guy, for him to endorse the Maharishi on the Merv Griffin show.
Hold that thought. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and William is just saying that, of course, the Maharishi hooked up with the Beatles, and even the Beatles became disillusioned with him when he was trying to certainly pursue Mia Farrell and other women. Supposedly he was celibate, but of course, even to the Beatles, it was obvious he was a hypocrite. Well, then, of course, Maharishi actually came to America for a second time and began to recruit prominent people, among those men like Clint Eastwood, who actually openly endorsed the Maharishi, and Merv Griffin. And as time went by, including more and more people from the Hollywood set and from the entertainment industry into his whole idea of transcendental meditation. What is transcendental meditation? Why, it's simply putting your mind into neutral. It's meditating on a word or an issue. And it is basically what the Hindu religion is all about, playing games with your mind and open yourself up, in my estimation, to demonic influence. But go right ahead, William.
Well, Dr. Stan, the endorsement by Clint Eastwood and Merv Griffin made the Maharishi acceptable to mainstream middle-class America, what Richard Nixon called the Great Silent Majority, which is the huge middle class here. And from there, that made him also appeal to the rest of the world. Now, continuously up till his death in 2008, the Maharishi consistently recruited the shapers of our entertainment and media business. Just consider, as we speak today, George Stephanopoulos is a TM practitioner. Oprah Winfrey is a TM practitioner. Ellen DeGeneres is a TM practitioner. Jerry Seinfeld is a TM practitioner. Dr. Oz is a TM practitioner. The number one medical advisor in the United States, who has a daily nationally syndicated program, advises his viewers to practice transcendental meditation. So he has cornered the TM movement, I should say, has pretty much cornered the entertainment industry, far more so than, say, the Church of Scientology, who have gotten like Tom Cruise and John Travolta and a few other stars, but they're quite paltry and small compared to the vast number of transcendental meditation practitioners who are also major Hollywood figures.
Well, William, but one of the things, certainly my producer had asked the question, many times in our churches, that the music in our churches has changed. And very often you'll have a song, and what it is simply repeating a phrase over and over and over and over again, the same little phrase, as part of supposedly a Christian song. And yet, in many respects, this is almost what transcendental meditation is. It sort of puts you into your mind in a neutral. Do you think that there's an element of this has infiltrated our music in the Christian churches as well?
Oh, definitely so, in both the Catholic and Protestant and even evangelical forms of music, the same sort of single repetition in one word. And it's interesting because the Maharishi once confided to someone he thought was a confidant. He said that he could bring the world to enlightenment by having everyone invoke the word Coca-Cola. The point is, if you repeat any word, no matter what it is, even if it's a Christian word or a Hindu word and sounds like a prayer, it puts you into hypnotic altered state of consciousness trance, and I'm a trained hypnotist, so I'm familiar with these techniques. And what that does is it makes you emotionally neutral and physically calm, which leaves you open to suggestion and manipulation by other people. It's ultimately a form of mind control, in the sense that when you're in this relaxed, unemotional position in your mind, you tend to please authority figures or want to please authority figures or do things that will cause the least resistance if people become demanding. So your producer is absolutely correct. This kind of single word repetition, I attended an evangelical church. It was for a friend of mine was actually getting some sort of award. And they took a Catholic kind of prayer and were using it in a similar hypnotic way. They were saying, Christ have mercy, Christ have mercy, Christ have mercy. Well, they weren't. There's two kinds of prayer. There's petitioning, where you ask God to help you. And there's adoration, where you praise God and thank him for creating you and acknowledge him. What they were doing was neither of those things, even though they were invoking Christ's name. They were using a neutral, repetitive sound to enhance a trance state by which people there again become spiritually and emotionally and even to a certain extent physically neutral. When they're in that frame of mind, there again, they are very susceptible to many kinds of mind control and manipulation, including, you know, monetary donations. And I did take note of this at an evangelical church. There again, if you're not petitioning God, like saying, God, please help me get well or help me pass this test or, you know, help me get through this situation, or if you're adoring God, if you're saying, you know, in thanking God and saying, you know, you're a wonderful God. Thank you for helping me. You know, thank you for creating the universe. Anything beyond those two forms of prayer can become very dangerous. And again, even if you use Christian words like Christ have mercy, if it's not in the context of thanking God or praising God or petitioning God, if it falls out of those realms of consciousness, then it becomes just like the Maharishi said, saying Coca-Cola, Coca-Cola, Coca-Cola. That repetitive noise causes, for you know, unknown reasons, human beings to fall into a trance state and become highly susceptible to suggestion and manipulation by authority figures or people who they see as authority figures. So that's a very important thing, even for Christians to watch out within their church. Now, I've even seen things that sound like Christian prayers, like praise the Lord, praise the Lord, praise the Lord. But if your intention, if you don't have your mental attention and your emotions, and even that part of you is spiritual, firing in the same direction when you make a prayer like that, you know, praise the Lord. If you don't have those three things simultaneously operating, even something that sounds like a adoration prayer or a petitioning prayer or a prayer of thankfulness, if your mind and soul are not in the right point of departure, so to speak, even terms like that can be misused by unscrupulous pastors and ministers and priests and rabbis and what have you. So remember, it's not necessarily the particular words, like take the name Jesus. Well, the name Jesus means very different things to a Mormon and a Jehovah's Witness and a Hindu. It's your definition of that word, and particularly what meaning you put behind it and what intention you have in petitioning it. So it's I know it's a very tricky thing to sort through and navigate, but God gave us reasons to do this. And one person who was very good at using Christian manipulation was the cult leader Jim Jones, who made all of his disciples commit suicide in the 1970s down in South America. He was an expert at using these Christian-type mantra repetitive words to cause his followers to fall into a trance state. And he would put things on the loudspeakers down there all day repetitively. The Lord loves you, Father loves you. The Lord loves you, Father loves you. Now, there again, it wasn't the words themselves. It was the intention and definitions behind them that caused these followers to fall into a trance state and eventually to become so susceptible to suggestion that they drank poison Kool-Aid at the orders of Jim Jones and died. So we as Christians have to be very careful, even when Christian terminology is being employed in our places of worship. We must ask ourselves and ask our clergymen what the definitions are, what the intentions of using these terms are, and what the ultimate concern of the whole congregation is by using these terms. And there again, theosophists use the name Jesus, and all kinds of bizarre Mormons, as I said, and unchristian groups will pose as Christians, use Christian terminology, but in reality, they're just using it to cause these sorts of trance states. That's why we all, whatever denomination you're in, I'm certainly for Christian fellowship. I have nothing against priests and ministers and even rabbis per se. However, we really must keep a critical edge when we're dealing with clergymen of every kind, because our spiritual longings make us susceptible in many ways to various forms of manipulation. And as fallen human beings, we can easily get our wires crossed and wind up in the wrong sort of mental prayer that is not what God intended in the Bible.
Well, now, thought with him, we're going to a break here, but I think it's vitally important that people understand these ideas of meditation, opening your mind, putting it to neutral, and the demons come in. Go right ahead.
Well, Dr. Stan, one prayer people always ask me, I'm not a minister, and I'm not a priest, and I'm not really a theologian. I have degrees in philosophy and religious studies and a minor in anthropology. But what I would recommend, if you want to say a prayer every day or have a daily spiritual life, the Lord's Prayer, the Our Father, try saying that first thing when you get up in the morning, when you're fully awake, and right before you go to bed. Try that twice a day for a month, and try and read some Christian scripture from the New Testament every day. And as far as what church or denomination you go to, that's really up to you. But make sure they're in line with a lot of the things I'm talking about. Make sure they see Jesus as being God, and make sure they don't use Christian terms to mask New Age and pagan and paranormal practices, because people can easily slip into the wrong sorts of things. I don't know anyone who is legitimately Christian who I've suggested this to, saying the Lord's Prayer first thing in the morning and before they go to bed, and at least trying to read some scripture or listen to it on YouTube, who's come back to me and said, that was a waste of time, or that was dangerous, or that was stupid. They usually find it fulfilling, and maybe not the first day or the first week. What I say is try it once for a whole month, no matter how you feel or whatever, and just commit yourself to 1 month and see how that goes. But stay away from these New Age Christian kinds of forms of really what transcendental meditation is, which is repetitive noises, which causes trance states, which causes people to be highly susceptible to not only manipulation by human beings, but also, for the Christians out there, manipulation by diabolical beings. Remember, it's the meaning of the word and the intentions that count, not the words themselves. I mean, even the name Jesus is from the Aramaic into Greek into English. It's not exactly the pronunciation that Jesus probably would have used in his lifetime. It's the meaning we put behind it. Jesus will know you are addressing him, even though I believe it's pronounced Yeshua or Yahshua in Aramaic. We change that to Jesus, but if you have the right definition behind it, the Lord will know you're talking to him. However, if you just blindly repeat, you know, Christ have mercy, Lord have mercy, and you have no specific definition or intention, you're heading towards one of these TM-type meditative techniques, which are ultimately psychologically and spiritually dangerous, in my opinion.
Well, I agree with you, and of course, this is what yoga is, putting yourself, your mind into a neutral position, and whenever you give over your mind to nothing, why does something comes into it? And this, of course, is the techniques by which the dark and sinister spiritual forces are able to seize control of the hearts and minds and souls of our people, and we're going to be back here in just a moment with William H. Kennedy right here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and William has simply been talking about the dangers of transcendental meditation, which is, of course, putting your mind into such a neutral position where it is no longer functioning at all. It is simply open to the entrance of demonic spirits, and this is what they do within the Hindu religion. And basically, they tap into this supernatural element. But the last thing you want to do is lose control of your mind by senseless repetition, or certainly by opening your mind up totally, certainly to these other forces out there. And basically, of course, that is what transcendental meditation does. And it is growing increasingly prevalent here in America and being practiced by many of the key people, not only into the intended entertainment industry, but I believe at the highest echelons of our government. Go right ahead.
Well, Dr. Stan, that's more of what I was discussing earlier was more of the practice of transcendental meditation myself. I would now like to get into the equally disturbing political aspects. We've covered the entertainment and the personal, but let's look at the Maharishi Mahesh Yogi's political background and ideas. When I said earlier the Maharishi Mahesh Yogi went to southern India in the 50s, he immediately hooked up with Hindu nationalists and fascist groups, literally fascist in the sense that these groups he hooked up with supported Adolf Hitler in the 1930s and 40s, and some of them even fought for the Japanese, the Axis powers, during the war with the intention of driving the British out of India. It was a British colony then. But these people were just as racist and bigoted and narrow-minded as Hitler or Mussolini or Hirohito or any of these fascists of the 30s. Now, when he came to the United States, despite the fact he hooked up with liberal entertainers, he really didn't care. He would use or manipulate anyone he could to get his ends, which was ultimately money, women, and political power. So essentially, the fact that a lot of these entertainers are technically liberal really means nothing when you consider that in the 2000s, he made his primary follower a medical doctor by the name of Tony Nader. What he did is he formed a monarchy, which he called the Global Kingdom of World Peace, and he had an elaborate Hindu ceremony where he coronated Tony Nader as the king of the world. And he argued that this was going to be a peace movement. Now, for a contribution of $1 million to the TM movement, Tony Nader, King Tony Nader, will give you a geographical area, and you will be the sub-king of the area. The term for king in Hinduism is Raja, and Tony Nader is the Maharaja, which means great king. But for $1 million, you can join up and get your own little kingdom. And he has divided the world up amongst these people who paid $1 million. Now, this sounds all kind of silly until you consider the fact that the TM movement tried to purchase land in Africa and South America to form their own physical sovereign state. And they have already produced their own international currency called a Ram. It's named after the Hindu god Rama. And on they even produce money, currency, and on it they have a picture of the Hindu god Rama with a complete picture of the globe on it, like a flat map globe with every continent on Earth on it. They have a flag of their kingdom or empire, which is actually, I was looking at it earlier, it's a fascist-type sun symbol that just looking at it is very hypnotic. I looked at it for a few minutes and stopped because I didn't like what it was doing to me. It was like it's a very hypnotic symbol, which I picked up upon pretty quick. Now, there again, all of this sounds quite ridiculous until you consider that Tony Nader has recruited the filmmaker David Lynch, who, by the way, movies, I love David Lynch's movies. He's one of my favorite directors. He did Blue Velvet and The Elephant Man and Eraserhead. I love him as an artist. However, he set up the David Lynch Foundation, and he's raising money amongst celebrities to teach transcendental meditation in the public school systems in the United States and Europe and India. And what David Lynch is doing in the United States is he's going to public school systems and saying, look, this TM technique is a really good treatment for ADHD and hyperactivity, and we will teach this to the kids here.
Hold that thought. Hold that thought. We're going to be back in just a moment with William Kennedy.
Let us swear allegiance to a land that's free. Let us all be grateful for a land so fair as we raise our voices.
William, you go right ahead.
Well, Dr. Stan, as I said, David Lynch is trying to infiltrate the school systems worldwide now through the David Lynch Foundation by teaching transcendental meditation, hopefully to every school-age child in the world. He's raised millions and millions of dollars. And what he says to the school system is, well, this really isn't a religion because you don't have to believe anything to practice it. And it won't cost the government any money because my foundation will pay for it. But we would like access to your public schools. Now, as I said earlier, these mantras they give out are actually the names of Hindu gods. So they're lying, number one. This is a form of Hinduism. And number two, certainly, at least in the United States, it violates the separation of church and state because you can't have Bible studies in public schools in the United States. You can't even have the Ten Commandments posted in a public school in the United States. But you can have this TM taught there because David Lynch is paying for it. Now, it becomes disturbing in that David Lynch, what they're trying to do is when the hearts and minds and souls of our children, our young people, they don't care too much about, like, I'm 48, they don't care what I do or think. What they're targeting are, like, children between, say, 8 and 16. And if they win the hearts and minds and souls of these young people and get them to do this trance-type meditation, they can introduce their fascist political ideas, which will eventually come out. Now, already they're teaching our children that they're not citizens of the United States, one nation under God with constitutional rights. They're taught that they are citizens of the planet. They are not taught that the Constitution and the Bill of Rights are essential. They are taught that the Constitution and Bill of Rights are actually secondary documents that need to be constantly reinterpreted or even avoided or forgotten about.
Hold the thought. We'll be right back here in just a moment. And Dr. Stan, William Kennedy's our guest. He's pointing out that certainly David Lynch, who has set up a foundation, and basically they're getting the transcendental meditation introduced into actually schools, not only in the United States, but throughout the world, and telling people that basically it's a treatment of attention deficit disorders and similar problems. It's not a religion at all. It's just a means of training the mind to work more efficiently. Whereas actually, of course, they have them then begin to repeat over and over again the name of Hindu gods. Basically, it's actually bringing the Hindu religion into our schools. Now, of course, you can't have certainly mention of God. You can't have the Bible. You can't even mention Christmas or Easter. Basically, they've taken the Ten Commandments out of our schools. And what are they doing? Well, they're bringing in transcendental meditation, which is Hinduism, and, of course, opening your mind for the demonic spirits. And this is going on all across America. And the fact that you're not hearing about this is simply a reflection of the degree of control that exists today over what the American people think. William, how effective had they been in introducing TM into the schools in America and in other countries?
Now, over the years, they have been sued by different school districts and have been taken out. And the situation now is they're very successful in particular areas. California, they're successful. Virginia, they've been somewhat successful. They're very insidious in that they're even willing to take public school children and teach them off outside of school, off the campuses and such. But they are offering themselves to school committees and medical doctors and things of that nature. So they're slowly and insidiously getting more and more children to practice transcendental meditation. I'm not talking in the tens of millions, but I am talking in at this point in the millions in the United States. They're much more successful in other countries because other countries tend to take anything that's free, no matter what it is. You know, if they give these kids lunch and teach it to them, that's one less lunch the government has to buy. So they're more than willing to do it. Now, it becomes even more creepier and insidious when you consider, as I said, King Tony Nadar, who I met in the 1980s in Boston, by the way, and on a personal level, I kind of liked him. He's a very smart man. He's a medical doctor. He's an internist, and he also has a PhD from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. So he's not a stupid man. He's a very brilliant man. And what's frightening me about it is my article, I should tell people they can read it for free, williamhkennedy.com. It's called Transcendental Meditation, Fraud, Philandering, and Fascism in the TM Movement. One thing that's really scary is that they are linked. This is the first article to link the Transcendental Meditation Movement and their global a community of peace to the Bohemian Grove and the Bilderberg Group. Now, the Bohemian Grove, for people who don't know, is a fraternity in California that consists of the richest men and the highest-ranking politicians in the world who meet there once a year and perform occult ceremonies, and also plan out a one-world government. Now, one major member of the Bohemian Grove was Merv Griffin, who I mentioned earlier, who was essential in introducing the Maharishi Mahesh Yogi into mainstream American culture. He is, like I say, the biggest thing that has promoted this movement. Merv Griffin was a member of the Bohemian Grove and was a subscriber to their plans to promote a one-world government and a one-world economy.
Well, let me just point out that there is a common denominator behind so many of the groups here, and many of the religions, certainly other than Christianity, and that is this idea of creating a one-world government and a one-world religion. In fact, the tragic thing, the frightening thing, is that the new Pope has already said that we all worship the same religion. Christians and the Muslims worship the same God. And this, of course, is this whole idea of the New World Order, of the New World Financial System, the New World Religion. Now, why would the Pope, certainly he has two PhDs, a brilliant man, want to try to convince us that Christians worship the same God? The Christians worship Allah. Allah is certainly not the God of the Bible. In fact, this is a demonic being, down the structure, been around for a long period of time. So why is the leader, the current leader of the Catholic Church, changing the entire direction, certainly of a religion that's followed by, you know, certainly almost a billion people? And basically you have to understand that these ideas of the world government, the world religion, permeate so many organizations, and certainly transcendental meditation is one of those myriad of organizations out there. And of course, as Sidney William points out, we're talking about the Bohemian Grove, we're talking about the Bilderbergs, all of these organizations that we talk about so frequently. Go right ahead, William.
Well, Dr. Stan, the political connections are just becoming more and more frightening. And as I said, a member of the Bilderberg group, which is basically the same group of people that belong to the Bohemian Grove and the Skull and Bones, these are three interlocking fraternal organizations. President Bill Clinton was a Bilderberg member, our former president, and his chief personal advisor, George Stephanopoulos, who does the news program now, has been a TM meditator for many, many years. And George Stephanopoulos got President Clinton to endorse the David Lynch Foundation. And if you go to the David Lynch Foundation webpage, there is a video of President Bill Clinton, our former president, endorsing the transcendental meditation technique as it is being used in on Native American tribes in the United States. The David Lynch Foundation is paying for different tribes like the Winnebagoes and the Washoes and Native people who basically been economically decimated over the years through very unfair treatment by the U.S. government and U.S. culture. I think the treatment of Native Americans has been very shameful in that sense and certainly does need vast improvement. And the problem is what David Lynch is doing and why Bill Clinton is supporting him. He's going into these decimated tribal cultures, teaching them transcendental meditation and paying for a very expensive and good food for them. A big problem with our Indians or Native American population in the United States is they have such poor diets that they have an extremely high rate of diabetes. They have a genetic predisposition towards diabetes, but they also have such poor, horrible, you know, fatty and salty diets that they have like a very high, like 60-70% in some tribes of the people get diabetes. And that's a big problem with the general American population anyway, but it hits Indians specifically. So David Lynch will teach them TM, and then pay for them to get really healthy, primarily vegetarian, organic foods. And just by changing their diets, it vastly improves their health and rate of diabetes. So these Native American tribes see this as like a wonderful miracle that's happening. And they've gotten the Bill Clinton Foundation has teamed up with the David Lynch Foundation to keep teaching Native American peoples the TM technique and giving them organic food. Now, I was friends with the Native American Indian civil rights leader, Russell Means, was a friend of mine. And what he pointed out to me is that the evil things that the U.S. government does to the general population, they first experiment with on Indian reservations. And this includes everything from bizarre medical experiments to police and federal military harassment. Everything they bad they do to the rest of the population, they generally try it out on Indian reservations first, because they're a pretty helpless population, number one. Number two, they're technically independent through treaties from the U.S. federal government, so they really can't sue the government for if something goes wrong or they're mistreated, because technically on paper, they're independent nations. So the TM movement is practicing their very bizarre herbal medicine and TM on the reservations with the full endorsement of Bill Clinton and money from Bill Clinton. And there again, this is just their testing ground to bring these more extreme forms of TM to the rest of the population. And as I say, these Native American tribes like the Winnebagos and the Washoes, they're so decimated and physically ill from the processed foods they've been eating that any improvement in their diet will make their lives much better, and any influx of money into their tribal councils will certainly make their lives better. So they are all for it, but they don't realize that, you know, they're being tricked into a big fall, because this is just another way of a form of mind control and manipulation, which, again, they test it on the Indians and then use it on the rest of us. And it's just, I find it personally extremely disturbing that Bill Clinton, through George Stephanopoulos, a TM meditator, has put up his money along with David Lynch to do this bizarre experimentation on our tribal peoples here in the United States. There again, with the ultimate concern of bringing it to us and the rest of the world. Bill Clinton is not a stupid man. He knows about the TM movement. He has even met Tony Nader, the man who claims to be the king of the world or global leader. So he's not ignorant of the ultimate concern of the TM movement to form this one world government with their currency. And he, there again, there, it's an insidious thing. They're going after our children, and they're going after our helpless minority populations so that they can bring this to the rest of us. People have to remember, Dr. Stan, fascism originally in Italy was a monarchical form of government. King Victor Emmanuel of Italy appointed Benito Mussolini as prime minister. He was never elected prime minister, and he did not seize the government. He was appointed by King Victor Emmanuel, and his economic policy was called fascism. Now, ultimately, when the war broke out and Italy started to lose the war and the Allies were invading, King Victor Emmanuel removed Mussolini from office. He was fired. So people say to me, well, what does a king like Tony Nader have to do with fascism? Well, the roots of fascism are monarchies. They involve the King Victor Emmanuel, Emperor Victor Emmanuel, he called himself, after Mussolini invaded Ethiopia. But the links between a king like Tony Nader and a fascist global economy are a reflection of the original intent of fascism as developed by Benito Mussolini in the 1920s. So we're looking at a global fascist government headed by King Tony Nader and backed up by the Bohemian Grove and Bilderberg Group through right now Bill Clinton. And as I say, as you mentioned earlier, there are different streams that are seeking to form this one world government and one world economy. You mentioned Pope Francis. Well, that's one stream where they could use the Pope and, say, some European monarch or political leader and make that person king of the world and have a one world economy and fascist government. If that doesn't work, let's say that's plan A. What the Bohemian Grove, their plan B will be to have this Tony Nader fellow be the king of the world and have his currency called the RAM be the one world economy currency.
Oh, but wait a minute. Somebody's called in and they wanted to know if you knew anything about Roy Masters' meditation program. Roy is certainly on radio programs all across America. He's been doing it for 20 or 30 years. Don't know how he's able to finance this thing, but he's trying to get people into meditation. Do you know anything about Roy Masters? And
no, I met Roy Masters 25 years ago when he came to Boston. Roy Masters teaches a meditation observation exercise. I believe he is a cult leader, okay? I don't like Roy Masters. How he gets his money is he formed a radio network, and he is actually the man behind Rush Limbaugh and Michael Savage. He originally hired them and made them international or national radio men, Rush Limbaugh being number one now. Both Michael Savage and Rush Limbaugh broke off by Roy Masters because he was so controlling. His form of meditation is like TM in the sense that it is a form of hypnosis that puts your mind into what you mentioned earlier, a neutral state. Now, what he doesn't tell people on his radio show is that when you go to his seminars, and I went to a few many years ago because a family friend of ours, the actress Eleanor Parker, who was in The Sound of Music, invited me to go, and she knew Roy, and I met him. But he does very bizarre Christian-type exorcisms, but the problem is he's Jewish. And there again, he has a very distorted view of who Jesus Christ is. His Jesus Christ is kind of this cosmic figure who's, he's not a Trinitarian Christian. He does not believe in the Father, Son, and Holy Ghost. He believes that Jesus is this exalted being who taught a form of meditation that Roy Masters discovered. Roy Masters was originally a jeweler. He was a diamond cutter who came to the United States, and he trained as a hypnotist. He was a stage hypnotist. And what he simply did is he used the hypnotic techniques that he learned as a stage hypnotist to manipulate people into doing his meditation and to even sending him lots of money.
And that's it. Basically, he's one of the most successful radio talk show hosts. He still has a network across America. Ladies and gentlemen, we are under attack from all sides. People must understand that. We're going to be back in just a moment to wrap up the program right here at Radio Liberty. Well, William, you've got 3 minutes to wrap up the program.
Well, Dr. Stan, go to williamhkennedy.com, read my article, Transcendental Meditation, Fraud, Philandering, Fascism, and the TM Movement. Educate yourself about it. Educate other people. Realize that this organization has extreme political motives where they want to initiate a global emperor in a global currency. It's dangerous. Find out if it's in your school system and try and have it removed. As far as Roy Masters goes, I would stay as far away from him as possible. He's not a Trinitarian Christian as in traditional Christianity. He practices an occult form of Christianity. One of his former daughter-in-laws says he beats his wife and children. There's been a lot of problems about him. Most anti-cult groups don't like him or the Maharishi. And again, at least take a look at my article, WilliamHKennedy.com, and get an idea of what's going on, because, as I said, this is being promoted by the people at the top of our entertainment industry and even former President Bill Clinton. So as silly as a lot of this sounds, making someone, you know, emperor of the world through this flaky spiritual group becomes incredibly frightening and serious when someone like Bill Clinton is right on the David Lynch Foundation TM website promoting the idea. Educate yourself, educate others. Make sure the brand of Christianity you belong to is Trinitarian. They believe in the Father, Son, and Holy Ghost, and that the prayers they're using are either petitioning, adoration, or thanksgiving, which is a form of adoration. But make sure they're in that realm. Read your Bible every day, and don't be afraid to break off from any church or spiritual group that you feel is deviating from authentic Christian principles. And, you know your rights, know your school committee, complain to your school committee if they're teaching anything that you feel is spiritual or religious. They're not supposed to be doing it. Complain to your state representatives. Operate on a local level. And remember, in the long run, we're going to win. We're on the right side. We're in a cultural Alamo and surrounded, but eventually the Calvary is going to come and we'll be spiritually rescued, unlike the people in the real Alamo years ago. We're going to ultimately win. So I'd like to thank you for having me on, Dr. Stan. God bless you, and God bless the Radio Liberty community.
God bless you too, William. We'll talk to you real soon. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and you go to WilliamHKennedy.com. That's WilliamHKennedy.com. Get his article. We're under attack from all sides. Most people don't understand that there are literally dozens of organizations out there, but they all have a common goal, a one-world government, a one-world financial system, and a one-world religion. And they're all subversive. And yet, of course, this is what dominates our nation today. At the national level, why do you think we have our troops in 130 nations and now we're sending our troops into 35 additional nations in Africa? Why do you think that just in the last 24 to 48 hours, one of the high Pentagon officials has said that the soldiers, American soldiers, are not allowed to profess the Christian faith because, of course, that is a treasonous activity, trying to let other people know that they are Christians and trying to win them to their point of view. Ladies and gentlemen, there is a conspiracy against God. There's a conspiracy against Christianity. America was great because America was good. But if America ever ceases to be good, America will cease to be great. Well, those words were spoken, actually written, certainly back in the 1840s, but they're as true today as they were. And also those words of Thomas Jefferson, "For God, who gave us life, gave us liberty. But can the liberties of a nation be secure when the conviction has been forgotten that liberty is the gift of God? I tremble for my country when I reflect that God is just, and his justice will not sleep forever." Those words are certainly chiseled into the white marble of the Jefferson Memorial. They were spoken by Thomas Jefferson, and you will never hear them quoted today. Because, of course, they want to make you think that he said there's a wall of separation between church and state. It's all a lie, ladies and gentlemen. Everything's a lie. Now, my ministry, Radio Liberty, is primarily listener-supported. If you're in a position to help us, we can certainly use your support to maintain our network of over 50 outlets every week. If you're in a position to join the Radio Liberty family of supporters or subscribe to our newsletter or get our products or certainly get the DVDs or the books or the CD sets we offer. And if you'd like a free catalog, we'll be glad to send you one. Or you can get the information at our website at radioliberty.com. That's radioliberty.com. And then, of course, we hope that you'll get my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, which will explain how this all fits together. You may want to get our 4-CD set on the supernatural or our 4-CD set on satanic crimes. because these crimes certainly infiltrate every aspect of our society. We deal a great deal with a supernatural element because it's a very real factor. It's working at the highest levels of our government. And what I call the Brotherhood of Darkness controls both political parties and makes mockery out of our electoral process. Every single one of our electronic voting machines can be rigged, and many of them are. You've got our forestry, again, our material on voting. But you certainly need to go to our website, radioliberty.com. That's radioliberty.com. And then, of course, we ask you to tell others about our ministry. If you're not in a position to help financially, to actually get our health products or certainly our spice products or our Miracle 2 products or our Berkey products, and incidentally, if you don't have some sort of a water filter, you need to have one. You need to have extra filters because we're moving into a very, very dangerous period. If you don't believe that, you need to get our CD on the threat of an EMP attack. That's a 4-CD set. 4 interviews with key people in Washington, D.C. Get our DVD. Ambassador Henry Cooper, a talk he gave for us on the threat of an EMP attack. We have the 2004 Congressional Commission report, about 100 pages. Congress was frightened to death. They still are, but they can't get anything done. There's a force, an invisible hand out there that is leaving us open to an EMP attack and one, a nuclear weapon. Detonated over Omaha, Nebraska, would end America as you and I know it. One nuclear weapon over Omaha, Nebraska, would end America as you and I know it. This is not an imaginary threat. Threat is very real. Our telephone number is 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. Please pray for America. Pray for revival, but pray for Radio Liberty. For our provision and our protection, because we're involved in a spiritual battle for the souls of men and the survival of Christian civilization.
Let us all be grateful for a land so fair. As we raise our voices in a solemn prayer, God bless America, land that I love. Stand beside her and guide her through the night with a light from above.
Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, that illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Christian civilization, it's going to be reality and not illusion or delusion that'll determine what the future will bring. I need to remind you the views expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, and well, for the next hour, they're going to be the views certainly of the William Grigg. And William, of course, was the senior editor of the New American magazine. He certainly was the editor of Republic for a time. Right now, of course, he writes a regular blog, certainly seen on Lou Rockwell. He actually has his own blog. He writes the monthly newsletter for Radio Liberty, and we appreciate that. He's a big help to us. But right now, without further ado, William H. Grigg. Hi, how are you doing, William?
Dr. Stan, I'm doing a lot better. It's always a pleasure to be with you every Friday. It's a real privilege and a blessing.
Well, William has had a bad infection of his leg. It's improving. Fortunately, we were very worried about him there. But anyway, he's getting better. It's about 2 weeks since he had the crisis situation. So we conclude the week. Last program on Friday was with William Grigg, because he does most of the talking, and I can just sit back here and enjoy it. William, what are we going to be talking about tonight?
I wanted to do a bit of a tour of the horizon, starting with an interesting email I got from a friend of mine who whose name I won't mention here. I've written about him in my blog. I wrote about him over 15 years ago in the New American Magazine. He's a former counter-narcotics investigator from a northeastern state who made the professional mistake of being part of a group that arrested a CIA-protected drug smuggling operation that was moving heroin and cocaine and other drugs all along the eastern seaboard. And within a couple of weeks, his career was ruined. And he and an associate were being framed on completely bogus civil rights charges. They were trying to railroad him into prison the way that Joe Acapinti had been railroaded into prison for doing the same thing. Mr. Acapinti had been, I believe, a Border Patrol agent who had busted a number of people who were connected to the same CIA-protected drug smuggling operation.
And I think it's very important that our listeners out there understand that probably the largest drug smuggler in the entire world is the CIA. And you can go back to the time of the Vietnam War. That was one reason we were over there in Vietnam, was to protect, of course, the CIA's sources of heroin. And now, of course, most of the heroin's coming from Afghanistan. Of course, when the Taliban were in control, they shut down the heroin trade. Now that the Americans are there, well, we have to have the heroin grow there, because after all, what would the farmers do? How would they make a living if they couldn't grow heroin? And so that's why, of course, we reversed the Taliban position, and we are, troops are over there protecting the heroin fields from those wicked Taliban who want to come in and take away the source of income for the Afghan farmers. Ladies and gentlemen, most people find it so difficult to believe, but go up on the internet and simply go to Google and type in CIA funds or CIA supports world heroin trade. You'll find literally hundreds of articles. Go right ahead, William.
Yeah, or look at the work by Gary Webb, the late Gary Webb, who's among that really elite and selective group of people that managed to commit suicide by shooting themselves twice in the head. Gary Webb, of course, was the wonderful journalist who was investigating the CIA's role in the crack epidemic back in the 1980s. And he ended up being professionally ruined and then suicided. But Gary Webb had been in contact with this friend of mine who's this former counter-narcotics investigator for a state police agency in the Northeast. But this fellow was just returning from down south, and he had to go through TSA checkpoints. And his experience as a commercial air traveler, in light of the scrutiny he's received from the federal government, is really quite interesting, and I want to share it with you and your listeners when we come back here in just a second.
All right, well, I think it's vitally important. Incidentally, if you'd like to get the information, we do have a four-tape set, includes my interviews with Gary Webb, who committed suicide by shooting himself in the head twice because he wanted to be sure that he was dead. We had a number of interviews with Gary before his tragic demise. William, you go right ahead.
Now, let me share what my friend wrote in this email that I received this evening. He said, just back from down south and a very embarrassing moment by the TSA. I guess I am still on the terrorist list. Went through the X-ray machine, took off my back brace. I should point out that my friend has a back condition. He's medically retired from his law enforcement career. Took off my back brace and gave it to TSA personnel and was stopped by three TSA agents and swabbed with a paper that was put in the ion analyzer again, even after I showed them my credentials. Then they physically searched me, and I was not allowed to leave until the ionizer came back clean. Then had to carry four bins by myself to the sitting area. It's really tough when you write the truth. That, of course, his observation about why he was being treated this way. Then on the way back, I was approached by a gentleman from the Middle East who was obviously an FBI informant who squeezed in beside me, and he was obviously a plant. Not once, but twice, and I refused to look his way even after he was staring at me. Then two U.S. Marshals were on my flight, a black and white team, ex-military, who do not know how to hide a weapon. The black guy was wearing a tight 50-50 linen jogging top, and his weapon was sticking out by his right hip so badly that everyone knew who he was. Now, this is interesting, of course, because he is making reference to this so-called TIDE list, which is the master list of people who were considered suspicious or unreliable or potential terrorists. This individual, as I pointed out before, is a law enforcement veteran, decades that he served in the state police. He had a record with no complaints before he got in trouble with the CIA. And he's describing the fact that he came, and this is by no means somebody who is of a paranoid cast of mind or given to fantasy or to melodrama. He made mention of the fact that he has published a book about his experiences, naming names and exposing what happened. But the type of treatment he receives is the type of treatment practically anybody can receive if you make yourself an irritant of sufficient magnitude. Just today, there was a news item talking about the fact that there are something like 875,000 names on this so-called Tide list, which is not described as a terrorist watch list, but it's a master list that is used to create the no-fly list. And the names that are on that list are not only provided to the TSA and to the FAA and to three-letter agencies in the federal government, state and local law enforcement, and so forth. They're also provided to credit bureaus. They're provided to the various bureaucracies that deal with the banking industry. And that can create a hassle not merely for people who are being singled out for harassment, like my friend obviously is. He's been living abroad for a couple of years. He actually fled the country.
Hold the thought. We'll be right back here. Well, Dr. Stan, certainly William has talking about getting a communication from a friend of his recently, a former certainly drug control. He worked in drug control, but he was doing a good job. He was trying to arrest the bad guys, and you're not supposed to do that because it embarrasses the CIA when you begin certainly uncovering their infiltration and control of the whole world drug industry. And people say, that couldn't be true. That just couldn't be true. Ladies and gentlemen, it is true. I've been following this thing for 50 years, and I will tell you the CIA is the largest producer and certainly, I should say, handler of drugs in the country. And of course, it's because the American troops are over in Afghanistan guarding the heroin fields that we have such a large heroin crops distributed throughout the world on a regular basis. But certainly, William's friend has been harassed. He's forced out of his occupation and now he's being repeatedly harassed. When he was trying to fly, why he was stopped by a team of FBI agents and he was followed by them and they searched him and certainly went to great lengths to try to embarrass and harass him. And this is what they do to people who tell the truth. And this is not new. I've known a number of people who this has happened to. And I would simply point out that a number of people that I've interviewed through the years have died under very mysterious circumstances. People like Gary Webb, who shot himself in the head twice to make sure he was dead. And I can think of a number of others who obviously were assassinated or were probably assassinated. That would be Jim Keith or some. In fact, Jim Keith was he had written a book called OK Bomb and went into the background of the fact that Timothy McVeigh had told his sister Jennifer that this is the man, of course, who was accused of blowing up the Murrah Building in Oklahoma. He told his sister that actually he had was working for a secret team, a special operations team involved in illegal activity. And shortly after Jim Keith wrote that book, OK Bomb, he died under very mysterious circumstances. Well, that could happen. You know, he had a minor surgical procedure and he ups and dies. But then shortly thereafter, his publisher dies. Well, that is certainly a coincidence. And then shortly after that, his ex-wife dies, all within a matter simply of a few months. Now, you may think that this just happens by chance. I don't think it happens by chance. It's happened too many times. Why am I still here? Why is William here? Well, I think certainly the Lord looks after William, and I hope the Lord has looked after us. We've been at this 50 years, and certainly I've had an awful lot of the people doing what I'm doing. Have certainly met with strange demises like William Cooper. William Cooper, they sent a SWAT team out, and they killed him. Mm-hmm. They claim, of course, he killed a police officer. That's why they had to kill him. It's sort of like we hear the Boston Marathon, this young man. Apparently, we're told, he came out from behind a car, and he's firing both of his guns at the police. Of course, he only had one gun. But he's firing at the police. We saw this on Rock Center 2 weeks ago. And they have these pictures. 200 shots were fired. Well, actually, they only had one gun between the two boys. And basically, of course, supposedly, he's walking, you know, towards the police, firing at them with no cover at all. He runs out of ammunition. He stops to reload his gun. Somebody tackles him, and then, of course, it turns out that he's killed. This whole story, can you honestly imagine somebody in a gunfight coming out from behind cover and walking into a fusillade of police bullets, you know, not firing two guns, but firing one. Go back and look at those pictures that they put on Rock Center on August 15th. Obviously, this whole thing is contrived, as phony as a $3 bill. And I'm going to be quiet, William. You go right ahead.
I think that it's worthwhile that you brought that up, of course, because just in the last 24 hours, we've seen that the family requested the body of Tamerlan Tsarnaev. And the body, of course, had been lying, as I understand it, in state or in the possession of a funeral parlor. And last night, literally in the middle of the night, the body was taken away from that mortuary in a hearse that had a police escort. Nobody knows where the body is. And that's just one example of many we could adduce where it makes people of sound mind and sober intellect and a healthy skepticism ask why it is that every time we get an official narrative, every critical piece of physical evidence that confirmed that narrative disappears conveniently, whether you're talking about, just to give one ancient but relevant example, the door that was part of the sanctuary at Mount Carmel outside of Waco in 1993. The story that the ATF told is that they were ambushed by Branch Davidians firing out through the door blindly at the ATF agents, and that was recreated in a government-sponsored piece of agitprop. It was broadcast on NBC while the siege was underway. They did an insta-propaganda film for NBC where they recreated the account that the ATF told, the completely implausible account, that they laid siege to the sanctuary, but they were ambushed because the Davidians shot through the door. The Davidians insisted that the ATF opened fire, and Koresh, who had been out trying to talk down the assailants, fled back into the sanctuary, closed the door behind him, and that they were being shot at through the door by the ATF. The door survived the fire, but it disappeared. That's one critical piece of information, critical piece of data or evidence, rather, that could have confirmed or disabused the official account. You, of course, have the destruction of the crime scene at Oklahoma in April of 1995, the demolition of what remained of the Murrah building in an untimely way that prevented independent investigators from examining the wreckage to decide, in order to determine whether or not an air-coupled blast from a large truck bomb could have created the asymmetrical damage pattern that was in that building. You have all kinds of destruction of physical evidence after the 9/11 attacks in Manhattan, and now you have the disappearance of the body of one of the two accused Boston Marathon bombers. After an eyewitness to this event said that the police account of this cinematic gunfight that you just related, Dr. Stan, was complete nonsense. And so every time you've got one other incident that I should point out is the convenient destruction, the burial at sea of what we were told was Osama bin Laden's body, you know, in the introduction of a heretofore unknown ritual involving the burial at sea for reasons of religious sensibility, supposedly.
And not only that, but the amazing fact that something like 23 or 24 of the SEAL Team 4 that as courageously was able to shoot this unarmed man, they've all disappeared. They've all died. And the man who had that died. So they, 23, somewhere 23 or 24 of the SEAL Team, and we're talking about within a year and a half, they're all dead. Does anybody out there in the audience really think that's coincidence? It's like certainly after the JFK assassination, there were over 100 people who were there on the grassy knoll or saw what happened that day or knew about to happen. Over 100 of them had very strange deaths within a matter of just a few months.
Yeah, when untimely death becomes contagious and then at some point becomes an epidemic, of course, you're dealing with something other than coincidence. And one of the reasons why we bring this up, of course, is because of what happened to my friend and the fact that he, as somebody who is a trained investigator, who is deeply immersed in law enforcement for decades, somebody who is not given to alarmist fantasies about himself or his surroundings, he picked up on the fact that he was being played by somebody who was obviously a federal plant. He was being shadowed by U.S. Marshals and came back into the country. That's of some concern, and it illustrates one of the dangers about this all-encompassing surveillance state that now has been created, which, according to Forbes magazine, CNN, I think, did the report a few days ago, the Homeland Security Department now, in inflation-adjusted terms, has spent more than the entire New Deal, the entire amount that was plowed into the socialist initiative called the New Deal that changed the nature of the federal government back in the 1930s and 1940s. We're dealing here with a new deal, and it's an authoritarian, hyper-authoritarian New Deal. It's the sort of thing that really is beyond the most emancipated fantasies of FDR and the collectivist clique who surrounded him. His brain trust could not have imagined having the type of vertically integrated, all-encompassing surveillance state that exists now. And at the center of it, actually not the center, one of its major appendages is this terrorism information data mart, so-called terrorist information data mart database that contains 875,000 names. And once your name or name identical to it is in that list, it can never be removed. As I mentioned before, this list is not only something from which we see the no-fly list and terrorist watch list being created, but this is a database that also is shared with credit agencies and people who are involved in the banking industry. And anytime you're involved in a transaction that requires somebody to extend you credit, or when a background check is being conducted when you're trying to buy a home or rent an apartment, if your name is in this so-called TIDE database, there are nearly a million people whose names are on it, chances are there's a red flag that's going to pop up somewhere, and you might find yourself being denied a loan or find yourself being denied an opportunity to buy or rent a home because your name is in this government database as somebody who's considered to be politically unreliable and potentially of a terrorist disposition. A few years ago, I believe it was 2005, there was a woman from Denver by the name of Sandra Cortez who hasn't been out of the United States in decades, who had an exemplary credit record and no criminal history. She went to, I believe, a Subaru dealer in Denver and tried to get a loan to buy a Subaru. And everything was going well. The dealers looked at her credit score. It was a very high credit score. She had clean credit. She had enough assets to buy the vehicle. And they were very congenial and very eager to sell her the vehicle. And suddenly a red flag popped up because there was somebody who had the same name, a very common Latino name, in the database, Sandra Cortez. The next thing you know, she's being interrogated about her whereabouts, her travel, whether she's been out of the country. She was denied the loan, and then things got worse from there in terms of her ability to conduct a normal life in our all-encompassing banking and credit system.
Well, unfortunately, basically, of course, what your name is on there, why you cannot get it off, you can't find out how it got there. And ladies and gentlemen, they can interfere with your ability to get loans. They can interfere with your ability to travel. We are setting up a police state right here in America. And as long as you aren't involved, most people aren't concerned, but they should be, because sooner or later, we'll all be involved. Well, William, you go right ahead.
Well, by way of elaborating upon what happened to Sandra Cortez, she spent, if I remember correctly, 4 or 5 years trying to find out how her name was inscribed on this database and how she could reclaim her life. She had to fight the federal government and several credit reporting bureaus for several years in court at some considerable expense. She was finally awarded, I believe it was a $150,000 judgment. And then a judge, a federal judge, without explaining why, reduced it by, I think, two-thirds. So she was awarded $150,000. The judge arbitrarily decided that this award, actually, it wasn't a civil settlement. It was an award by a jury in a civil lawsuit, a federal lawsuit. The judge, acting proprio motu, without explaining why he did this, reduced it from $150,000 to $50,000, and then the government sold two-thirds of that in taxes. She ended up with, I believe, between $15,000 and $20,000, which didn't cover her legal expenses for this protracted ordeal of trying to find out how it was that her name ended up on a terrorist database. Once again, Sandra Cortez is not an uncommon name. It's like Jane Smith, if you go to certain parts of Latin America. And of course, her family is from Latin America. I think she was from El Salvador, but don't hold me to that. In any case, after this 4 or 5 year ordeal, she discovered that her name is still on the database, because once your name is on the list, it can't get off. And this is something into which is fed every single encounter we have with anybody wearing a government-issued costume who's part of the Homeland Security apparatus. And the reason why I started this discussion by talking about this experience of a fellow who was a career law enforcement officer, a cop, a police officer, is to illustrate the fact that there has been this cultural shift. This fellow is in his, I believe, late 50s, maybe even his early 60s by now. He's from a different generation. He's from a generation of people who tried, and he describes in his book several instances where, rather than pulling a gun, he de-escalated conflict. In one instance, he actually found himself being dragged by an automobile. He had his hand inside an automobile trying to turn off the ignition by turning off the key, and the motorist took off and was dragging him at not a considerable rate of speed, but not for a terribly long distance. But we are talking about somebody being dragged by a 2,000-pound hunk of metal that's propelled by exploding fuel. This is obviously a life-threatening situation. And what he had been taught is that in a circumstance of that kind, it's, of course, a threat to life, limb, and public safety, that he had the right to use lethal force. But he didn't. You know, he made a conscious decision not to use lethal force. In other words, he was trained to be a peace officer. He was somebody who understood the logic and necessity of de-escalation, that it was preferable to do this. He was somebody who didn't tune up suspects. He didn't take pleasure in physically manhandling people he was arresting. He was given numerous reviews in which it was clear that he got along well with the public. And he's since developed misgivings about the whole war on drugs. He's talked about the fact that some of his friends and some of the people he had met as a law enforcement officer and as a counter-narcotics officer had their lives ruined by narcotics. And, of course, narcotics are horrible things. Narcotic abuse, I should say, is a horrible thing. There are circumstances, I suppose, in which there might be medicinal uses for some of these substances. I'm very skeptical. As somebody who believes in the principle of self-ownership.
Hold that thought. Hold that thought. We'll be right back in a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and certainly William was just saying that Sandra Cortez, that this woman who had had her name placed on the no-fly zone, on the watch list, on the terrorist list, eventually, of course, got a $150,000 judgment from against the federal government. A jury heard what it was and certainly gave her that. And then the judge reduced the settlement to $50,000. And by the time they got through paying all the expenses and the taxes, she ended up with about $15,000. She wasn't even really able to pay all of her legal expenses for it. And then she found out that despite the fact that jury had given her a settlement, her name was still on the no-fly list, on the terrorist watch list. And basically, we have certainly a vast bureaucracy out there that isn't interested in anything other than harassing our people. We're going to lose our freedom unless we do away with the Department of Homeland Security, which came about after the September 11th attack. And ladies and gentlemen, go and watch the Twin Towers come down. Watch, certainly, how's the top of the buildings collapse before the rest of the building comes down. Why would the tops of the buildings collapse? I thought it was certainly a gravity collapse. Understand, watch Building 7 come down. You realize, of course, that's a controlled demolition. Or look at the pictures of the Pentagon with an 18-foot circumference hole right adjacent to the ground in the Pentagon. And we're told that a 757 plane, the wings, the motors, everything went into that hole, except I talked to a woman who was in the building and came out through the hole, and there was no wreckage in the hole, and she was immediately threatened by government agents if she ever told the truth. Well, she's brought a suit against them. I don't know what's happened. I hope they haven't done to her what they've done to Gary Webb, who shot himself in the head twice to make sure he was dead. We're talking, ladies and gentlemen, not things imaginary. We're talking about what's really going on in America today. And that's why you have to be involved, because they're not concerned that they killed almost 3,000 people on September 11th. And in fact, six of the hijackers, you can check this out on the internet, six of the hijackers who hijacked those planes that day and died that day are alive and well living over in the Middle East. just go to your Google and type in six 9/11 hijackers alive in the Middle East today, and you'll find they are. And if you can explain how they were dead and then they came back to life and they're living and well, why, I'll believe anything you tell me. Go right ahead, Will.
Well, it makes much sense. The story we were told about the reasons why they supposedly disposed of Osama bin Laden's body when they did. I mean, the fact that they would claim to have killed this individual when they could have captured him, of course, and assuming that he was some kind of combination of Fu Manchu and Ming the Merciless with the touch of Ernst Stavro Blofeld, he would have been an incredibly valuable intelligence asset. And that's, of course, the sort of thing you would prefer to do if we're actually fighting this all-encompassing enemy that is constantly on the assault and threatening us with every breath we take. But the thing about what we're talking about with respect to my friend, the former state counter-narcotics officer, is that he developed some misgivings about the war on drugs. He came to understand that you're dealing here with a prohibitionist racket where the purpose is not to limit the social impact of drugs, something he had seen, and something that, of course, is obvious to anybody. Drug use, drug addiction is not harmless. It's something that does horrible things to people, as any addictive behavior will. I mean, we're living in a country that's full of addictive behaviors that are cultivated and nurtured by the people who presume to run our lives. The point is, of course, that when you have a prohibition in place, there are people who profit off that prohibition, and they tend to be the worst elements of society, whether you're talking about drug cartels in Mexico or the banks in the United States, just name any of the elite banks that launder the proceeds, or that you're talking about the CIA, which presides over this entire mess and has a huge volume of off-the-books revenue that can use for the purpose of fomenting insurrection and chaos and bloodshed overseas and then making life miserable for people like my friend. But this man, as I pointed out, is from a different generation. He sees things differently. He became a police officer, as so many have, out of a desire to protect life, liberty, and property. He wanted to be a peace officer. He did not want to be a servile cog in this vast apparatus of deception and corruption and cronyism that he discovered. And now, of course, that he is exposed what's going on because he conscientiously did what he understood to be his duty and found himself on the receiving end of this kind of treatment as a result, he wrote an expose that's been given modest circulation, but some of us have tried to make very prominent. And that's one of the reasons why he finds himself on the end of gimlet-eyed hostile stares from federal air marshals and being targeted for obvious harassment and provocation by people who are obvious federal plants. That's the way this system runs. It's soft totalitarianism, but it's soft totalitarianism of the quick hardening variety.
I certainly agree with you. And ladies and gentlemen, you must understand that reality is usually scoffed at and illusion is usually king. And most of what we think we know isn't true. And that's why it's so important to get the information from people like William, who's been certainly an investigative reporter for many years, and encourage others to listen to our programs and learn what they'll never get through the regular media.
While a storm cloud gathers far across the sea, let us swear allegiance to a land that's free. Let us all be grateful for a land so
William, you go right ahead.
I think that one of the real tragedies of the era in which we're living is that people like my friend, and I've mentioned some other really conscientious people like Ramon Perez, who's a former police officer from Austin, Texas. And there's a fellow whose memoir I recently read from New Jersey by the name of Justin, I believe it's Hopgood, who's a former state trooper, and Regina Tasca, who was a police officer from Bogota, New Jersey. These are the sort of people who get flushed out of the system because they still insist on behaving like peace officers rather than being part of a tribe that is increasingly, of course, controlled by the federal government. They receive their funding from the federal government. They receive their training from the Pentagon. They're equipped by the Pentagon, by the Homeland Security Department. They're no longer accountable to the cities and communities and neighborhoods where they are assigned to patrol. There's a depleting, ever-diminishing number of people who meet that description. And I've said before, 20 years ago, almost exactly 20 years ago, when the COPS bill was being proposed by the Clinton administration, I used to exercise, just go to a health club with a number of people who were planning on becoming some of the federally funded police officers. And they were very different from the deputy sheriffs and police officers I had known when I was a teenager, when I'd go on ride-alongs with law enforcement officers at the time, who considered themselves once again to be peace officers rather than law enforcers. The people I saw 20 years ago who were going into the system were mercenaries. They were young, ambitious mercenaries who wanted a paycheck, and they weren't all that fastidious about how they would get it or the things they were going to be required to do. That was 20 years ago. That's a generation ago. So we're dealing now with a definable, palpable change in the way the system was set up. That was even before September 11th. And in the last 12 years, as I mentioned before, we've seen an outburst of spending larger than that behind the New Deal. The New Deal irrevocably changed, I'm afraid, the way that the federal government operated with respect to the economy and with respect to the management of our lives in terms of what we do in transactions.
Hold that thought. Hold that thought. We're going to be back in just a moment with William Grigg. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and William is simply talking about how, suddenly, 20 years ago, he went to the gym, worked out with a number of men who were going to go into federal law enforcement. Now, their attitude is simply much different than that that went into the sheriff's office, the police, who really wanted to be peace officers. But those going into the federal government realized this was a way to assume power and certainly to advance their careers, and they weren't interested in idealism. They were interested in getting ahead. They had a much different, certainly, outlook on the world. And of course, since September 11th, now that we established the Department of Homeland Securities, and we're beginning, of course, to militarize our police across America. Look at your police officers. Look at the SWAT teams, ladies and gentlemen. Look at the police officers wearing military uniforms and military helmets and carrying automatic weapons and carrying all sorts of, certainly, all explosives and tear gas bombs. And then they have, of course, their motorized or their militarized armored carriers. There are 2,700 of them disseminated across America as we move from being a free society into a police state. And this is being done in the name of protecting us from those wicked terrorists. And yet, if you go up on the Internet and you simply type in CIA funds Al-Qaeda, you'll find that the CIA and Pakistan and Saudi Arabia all working together to fund the terrorist movement. We've created the best enemy money could buy. Until you understand that, most of what is going on doesn't make sense. Who is funding the terrorists in Syria? We are. Who are they? They are certainly Al-Qaeda. Who funded the Al-Qaeda terrorists in Egypt and in Tunisia and Libya? We did. Who's fighting Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan? We are. And yet there's hardly anybody there. Back in 1970, back in December of 2009, Steve Croft, suddenly asked President Obama why he was sending an additional 30,000 troops to Afghanistan, bringing our troop concentration up to 90,000 when there were less than 100 members of Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. And the president said, without hesitation, my job is to protect the American people. Those members of Al-Qaeda there in Afghanistan are plotting against America, and my job is to protect you, and that's why we're sending an additional 30,000 troops. Ladies and gentlemen, reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. Go right ahead, William.
It's fascinating to bring up the fact that the official policy of the Obama administration and many of the Republicans in Congress is to provide material aid to those elements of the Syrian rebel faction that are connected to Al-Qaeda, or that are an outgrowth of a group that called itself Al-Qaeda in Iraq. Of course, they're not part of a definable network called Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda is a brand name. It's a catchphrase, the buzzword. these aren't local franchises of some kind of internationally organized group. They're people who are adopting tactics and using a name, basically. But the point is that these are people who had been fighting U.S. troops in Iraq. They are folks who are totalitarian in their outlook. They're deeply anti-Christian. They're opposed to Shiite Muslims and, of course, the Alawite sect, the supposedly heretical Alawite sect that is running Syria, is looked upon by this group that the U.S. is funding as infidels who are suitable only for slaughter or subjugation. And as I mentioned last week, members of this group that are receiving material aid from Washington. And just in the last couple of days, Mr. Obama and his underlings have been talking about, I don't know if they're his underlings or his handlers. It's difficult to say when you're talking about a president who's actually in charge here. But Mr. Obama and other figures in his administration have been speaking openly about providing lethal aid to this group in Syria.
Let me just interrupt.
It's already underway.
Let me just interrupt with him. I read that. You know, they're thinking maybe we ought to provide weapons to these people. Ladies and gentlemen, they've been providing weapons all along. We have special forces units in both Jordan and in Turkey that are funding and financing and training and arming them, and they have for the last almost 2 years. But basically, they can't let the American people know that. And so suddenly we're reading these articles that President Obama is thinking about maybe we're going to start providing weapons for them. Ladies and gentlemen, where do you think they're getting their weapons now? Who do you think is providing the weapons and funding and training these terrorists there in Syria? Why, we are. We always have. And certainly the Saudis are, certainly Pakistani intelligence. They all work together to find and train the terrorists. But you have to have an enemy. If you're going to have a war, you got to have an enemy. And so we fund the enemy, the finest enemy that money could buy. And eventually, of course, we're going to war with the Muslim world. But we've been funding the Muslim Brotherhood going back to the Second World War. And if you haven't read the book, The Devil's Game, you need to get it. Now, conclusion is, why, of course, we just made a mistake. They didn't make a mistake at all. The MI6 started funding the Muslim Brotherhood back in 1928, by the end of the Second World War. Great Britain was certainly bankrupt, so CIA picked this up. They knew exactly what they were doing. They want to make you think, oh, we just made another mistake. These people don't make mistakes. They know exactly what they're doing, but they do not want the American people to know, and you go right ahead with it.
I want to underscore the reliability, in my opinion, what you said about the fact that the Syrian resistance, so-called, has been receiving lethal aid from Washington for a number of years. What's happening, of course, is now we're seeing the staggered rollout of a public admission of that fact. And when they've been talking of providing non-lethal aid to these radical groups that are part of this coalition, they're not talking about rain ponchos and MREs. They're talking, of course, about battlefield intelligence. They're talking about the type of material support that would make it possible for them to use the weapons and training that are provided by the U.S., Saudis, Pakistanis, and the Brits, probably people working for the Israelis as well, to make effective use of what they've been given. But the point is that these are all, of course, deeply embittered anti-Western terrorist groups. They are part of that group of people to whom you refer as the best enemy that money can buy. And, of course, just within the last several hours, we've heard that Israel has carried out an attack on positions in Syria, and they've been saying that this is justified by the possibility that Syria's chemical weapons and other munitions of that kind would fall into the hands of radical Muslim groups in the insurgency, which is the same insurgency the United States has been supporting and most likely has been receiving support from Israel as well.
And basically, if you think this doesn't make sense, you're absolutely right. But we've been telling our listeners for the last 3 or 4 days that Israel has called up the reserves.
Yeah.
Have you read about this, your local newspaper? Does your local ABC, CBS, or NBC outlet tell you that Israel is causing up its military reserves? Of course not. But we covered that that well last night. We've covered it for several days. And now, of course, we see Israel striking out. And this may be just the beginning of an expansion of that war over there. If we're sitting on the edge of some very, very dangerous times, ladies and gentlemen, make your preparations accordingly. Go right ahead.
And one of the things that's happening, of course, is that every time there's a tremor of unrest overseas, or every time there's an incident that suggests that there's a possibility of blowback here. And this blowback, of course, is what happens when we see the supposedly unintended consequences of a CIA intervention, when you have retaliation against CIA subversion of a government or CIA initiative or an initiative by some other element of the U.S. government that results in dead innocent people in a foreign country, and you see anti-U.S. Resentment arise, take the form of anti-U.S. terrorism. They call that blowback, as if it were an unintended consequence. Of course, they can't control these things down to a level of specificity, but in broad outline, there are certain predictable things that happen. If you do certain things, you can expect certain results. If you continually bombard a country that has done no harm to you and poses no threat to you, it shouldn't surprise us if ere long you're going to find some kind of retaliatory violence. If you invade and occupy a country, you're going to see suicide bombings. You're going to see suicide bombings that target the most vulnerable elements of the occupation. That's something that's happened for decades. I mean, you saw that sort of thing happen in Palestine after World War II, when the Jewish partisan groups were trying to drive the Brits out of Palestine. You've seen that happen in places like Lebanon. You've seen it happen in Sri Lanka. It's just predictable. So the people who are in charge of these policies understand with some expertise that when you do certain things that result in injury to distant people, you can expect a certain type of reaction. And I am cynical enough to believe that this is what they intend. And what really haunts my sleep is the fact that for at least 4 years, probably longer than that, the Obama administration, well, and the Bush administration before it, have been carrying out these drone attacks in Pakistan, which is a nation of 180 million people. It's a nuclear power. It has been for a long time. It's a Muslim country that's full of people who are highly volatile, who historically have directed their enmity at India, because at one point they were both part of the same Raj that was ruled by Great Britain. Of course, the fracture happened decades ago between India and Muslim Pakistan, which had been part of India up till that point. They don't like the Indians. They're both nuclear armed powers. Every year, of course, they have a ritual in which they express their continuing enmity for each other. But in the last year or so, according to public opinion polls, the temper of the Pakistani population has shifted to where the United States is viewed as the chief enemy. And this is because the United States has been carrying out this incessant drumbeat of drone attacks in Waziristan and other parts of Pakistan that have resulted in, according to Lindsey Graham, the senator from South Carolina who's in support of this program, it's resulted in at least 5,000 deaths. And you've got a ratio of about 9 to 1, 9 innocent bystanders to 1 targeted militant. And, of course, the definition for militant is almost infinitely expandable and uncannily flexible. And many of these strikes, of course, double-tap strikes, where you have a drone fire a missile at a targeted region, which is occupied by a targeted individual, generally somebody who's not known by name, but is profiled on the basis of what they call a pattern of life analysis. And then within 10 minutes, you have a second strike, and the second strike targets the first responder.
Well, why would they want to hit innocent people who were just there trying to help William?
Yes.
That doesn't make any sense unless you are trying to have people hate America.
Well, if that's their objective, they've succeeded wildly. And I can't credit that these people are ignorant. You know, after you've accounted for ignorance and stupidity, what you're left with is deliberate malice. These people are obviously not stupid. Stupid people don't build sophisticated systems of that kind. They don't train the type of people who can use them so efficiently. That's not stupidity. Ignorance, of course, would require that these people insulate themselves from knowledge that is easily obtainable. If you have a laptop computer or a smartphone, you can find out what's going on. You can understand what's happening in terms of the rancor and resentment that is roiling in Pakistan at the expense of the United States. So ignorance has to be crossed off the list. What you're left with is deliberate malice.
And basically what's happening is we are developing a sense of hatred for America in Pakistan and in Iraq and in Iran and all throughout the Muslim world. And although there may be animosity between the Sunni and the Shia Muslims, there is a common hatred of America, and this is being actively fostered by people in our government. Now, why would we do that? Well, if you're going to have a war, you have to have hatred. You got to get us to hate the Muslims, and you get to get the Muslims to hate us. And when you understand that, things begin to make sense. Otherwise, none of this makes sense. Why would you want to target the first responders, people rushing to help people who've been damaged by a drone attack? And then, of course, you rush in to help them, and then you get killed or maimed or crippled as well. Go right ahead, Jim.
And, of course, what we're talking about here is a much more sophisticated and much more deadly version of what happened with the Boston Marathon bombing, where they had the two staggered explosions. And this is something that has been sort of a hallmark of the use of IEDs overseas by rebel groups, insurgent groups, by terrorists. It's the sort of thing that has been used by many of the groups that are on the U.S. government terrorism list. You've seen Hamas and Hezbollah make use of these double-tap-style strikes, often called breaks, where you have one explosion and then a second explosion is detonated at a certain distance where you predicted that people will flee to after the first bombing or where first responders will assemble. The U.S. government's using exactly the same strategy to carry out these targeted, and they're very poorly, coarsely targeted strikes in Pakistan, a country with whom we are not at war, never have been at war, that is supposedly an ally in the anti-terrorism struggle. The other thing that's happening, and I'm indebted to Philip Giraldi, the former CIA analyst who writes for the American Conservative, for this little piece of intelligence, is that the CIA is not only conducting this open-ended drone war in places like Pakistan, Yemen, Somalia, and so forth. They're actually setting up a system now where these wildly unpopular and corrupt client rulers of the United States in Iraq and in Afghanistan and in post-Assad Syria, they're already planning for post-Assad Syria, as well as in Yemen, are going to be able to call upon CIA-controlled drones for the purpose of what they call regime protection. So they're going to create satellite replicas of this drone program that will be operated on behalf of these client states. This is the sort of thing that the Soviet Union would have been doing if they would have had the technology 25, 30 years ago. And it really is the sort of thing that is going to engender the hostility we're describing. And Dr. Stan, I have to agree with you. There seems to be deliberate design to bring about this catastrophic clash of civilization, because that's the only explanation that makes sense in light of what we can document, in the light of the fact that we're not dealing with stupid or ignorant people. They're foolish, of course, but they're not stupid or ignorant. They're foolish and they're malicious, and that's a really bad alloy.
Of course, I have the advantage. I've read the scriptures, and I know
there you go.
I know there's going to be a great war over there against Israel. There's probably going to be several wars against Israel, and maybe we're preparing for the Psalm 83 war. It's going to be fascinating to see how it plays out. But, ladies and gentlemen, we're on the edge of some cataclysmic events taking place in that part of the world. And if you think that we're going to suddenly escape from any possible damage or danger, here you're mistaken. William, quickly, how can people get to your website, get your information, get to your PayPal button?
It's called Pro Libertate, ProLibertate. Type that into Google along with my last name, Grig, and that'll bring up my blog, which is called Pro Libertate, or go directly to freedominourtime.blogspot.com. freedominourtime.blogspot.com. The PayPal button is at the bottom of every essay, and I am greatly indebted to you, Dr. Stan, and many people in your audience have been so generous, particularly in the last couple of weeks while I've been facing this health crisis. They've been exemplary and generous beyond measure, and we're deeply grateful to you and to them.
Well, I got so interested in what we were talking about, I almost didn't get the most important part of the program out. We'll be back in just a moment to wrap up. William, we've got 3 minutes to wrap up the program.
Dr. Stan, once again, I want to thank you for this opportunity. It's always a privilege and a blessing to be with you, and I'm deeply appreciative once again for everything that you have done on behalf of me and my family, and for the many, the almost countless acts of generosity, particularly in the last couple of weeks.
Well, don't forget Barbara, because she's the major instigator of all this. Anyway, she loves you dearly.
Yeah. Well, God bless and God love Barbara. She's wonderful, too. And it just means a great deal to me, more than I can adequately express. And one of the things that I want to reiterate, and this is something you touched upon just toward the end of our discussion here, is that we're not living in an unsponsored universe. I mean, we're not dealing with things that simply happen. We're not merely matter in motion. We're made of finer stuff than our senses can fully perceive. We are beings that are not time-bound, who are living in time-bound circumstances. One of the reasons, of course, why it's so important to read the scriptures, one of the reasons why it's so important to contemplate seriously and soberly our place in the universe and our relationship to the creator of the universe, the author of the moral law by which we're supposed to live. Like you, Dr. Sten, I am a believer. I'm somebody who is consumed with a passionate desire to protect human freedom and dignity, because it's something that was implanted in my heart by the creator that gave us life and gave us liberty. And it offends me at a level, well, much deeper than that of the flesh, to see the fact that there are people who impudently deny the liberties that we were given by our creator, who believe that we are in some sense their property, that they want to arrogate to themselves the respect and the reverence that are due uniquely and exclusively to the author of our liberties. And that's one of the reasons why this is so important to me, and why it should be so important to all of us, that we focus on the fact that amid our trials, that our sufferings and the turbulence that surround us, there still is reason, there still is order, there still is a creator, and he's not amused by what's happening, and he will vindicate our rights. He is, of course, sufficiently minded to save us, whether we're talking about time or eternity, as long as we are willing to do those things which are in harmony with his will.
Well said. Well, our guest has been William Grigg, and I appreciate everything you're doing. William, please keep in touch with us. I hope you keep getting better. And
I appreciate
that. We'll be with you again next week at the same time, hopefully, if God willing. Good night.
God bless. Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
While the storm clouds gather all across the sea, let us swear allegiance.
Well, this is Dr. Stan. We do hope, of course, that you enjoyed the program this evening with William Grigg. I always do, but William is certainly one of the most astute individuals we have, and we always enjoy his commentary. Now, if you'd like to know a little bit more about how we fund the World Terrorist Movement, you need to get the book. It's called The Devil's Game. We carry it. If you'd like to know what really happened, certainly on September 11, 2001, we have a great full-length movie. It's fictionalized, but there's nothing of fiction in it. It's basically what happened, although it's put into a commentary. And basically, it's called Operation Terror. We've already sold almost half of what we have. Operation Terror, we recommend it to you. We also carry certainly a talk that was given, the Robert Gates he gave here, a DVD by Robert Gates. We have 2 DVDs that he has actually produced. And you must understand that what happened on September 11th is not what most people think. We have a 4-tape set on 9/11. We have a 4-tape update called 9-1-1. one update. We have a four CD set, Why Did the Buildings Come Down? One of the interviews with certainly Leo Chavez, Sergeant Leo Chavez, who was at CENTCOM headquarters that morning, and he disappeared after he did this talk. The other is a gentleman who was in charge of cleaning up. He arrived the day after. His job was to clean up the debris of the building number 7, and he says openly, he's 99% sure that building 7 came down because of controlled demolition. That's what his job. He cleans up controlled demolition, and building 7 was a controlled demolition. They kill those people, ladies and gentlemen. They kill them. And if they would kill them without hesitation, and they're able to put that over, who is going to protect you from the forces of evil that are aligned against humanity today? Our telephone number is 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. You need to get my book, Brotherhood of Darkness. You need to read it, circulate it. We certainly have somewhere between 60,000 and 100,000 copies of the book out across America today. And you need to get it into as many people's hands as you can so they can understand the true nature of the spiritual battle that's taking place today. But let me mention the DVD, and it's really made as a full-length movie, Operation Terror, the story of what really happened on September 11th. Operation Terror. We carry Richard Gates' 2 DVDs, and remember, he has over 1,800 architects and engineers who've signed a petition stating, we need another investigation because those buildings didn't come down the way we were told. If they didn't come down, ladies and gentlemen, that means they murdered. They murdered almost 3,000 people that day. They really intended to murder more. But, of course, they kept telling the people at Morgan Stanley in the South Tower, stay at your desk. Don't get up. Stay at your desk. Oh, there's a fire over the North Building. Nothing to worry about. And the man in charge of security ran up and down the aisles on 2 floors shouting, get out, get out. This is a terror attack. And 2,400 or 2,500 employees of Morgan Stanley left the building, or they would have died as well, and they wanted to kill them. We're up against organized evil, ladies and gentlemen. We're up against organized evil. If you'd like to know how they killed Bobby Kennedy, we have a 4-CD set on the murder of Bobby Kennedy. We have a 4-CD set on the murder of Martin Luther King, including interviews with a lawyer who was hired by Martin Luther King's family to bring out the truth. And they even had a lawsuit, and that they actually had a criminal trial with a judge and a jury, a real judge and a real jury, and not one word in the controlled media. They can't let you know they killed Bobby Kennedy, and they killed Jack Kennedy, and they killed Martin Luther King. And they tried to kill everybody on board the USS Liberty. We've got a great 4-CD set on that. They're all available by calling 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. Go to our webpage, radioliberty.com, where you can certainly look at all the items that we have available and so much else. And then, of course, if you're in a position to help financially, we'd love to hear from you. We need your help to maintain the network we have. And then we ask you to pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection.
Truth, it's the evidence, and it's what is in your heart. And I am just so honored to be a part of the Power Hour with all of you out there, all of our family members, our cousins, our brothers and sisters, and even distant cousins out there in Power Hour land. Thank you so much for joining us today. It's going to be Feel Good Friday, but we got a lot of news that will require some duct tape. It will, unfortunately. I've hoped that it wouldn't, but it will require some duct tape. So I'm glad that you're joining us today. We're going to have Feel Good Friday, and we'll have Rick joining us at about 9:30. Rick Kaler from Rick's Satellite Fame join us. If you're listening to the news, we've got a Korean guy who was a tour guide who was in North Korea along the border of North Korea and China that it looks like we're going to have to go save. I kid you not. I mean, you would think that this guy was critical to the infrastructure of the United States from its diplomatic relations.